And it was really enlightening to me, the idea that Colin Woodward has put it forward there, that you've got these regions in this country, I think certainly rings true. And to your point, Beth, about sort of the history of both coasts, we celebrate that. And for the left coast, at least, this sort of intersection between El Norte and the coast, the values that we have, sort of the history, I think makes for, you know, part of coming back to that healthy competition, a real pursuit to try to figure out how to be as accessible and equitable to the constituencies in the state.
This is Sarah Stewart Holland.
And this is Beth Silvers.
Thank you for joining us for Pantsuit Politics. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Pantsuit Politics. Today, we are sharing the latest in our Now What electoral series, where we use Colin Woodard's regional framework to understand different parts of the country, particularly as we move closer and closer to the midterm elections. Today, we're going to be tackling El Norte and New Amsterdam, aka Southern California, mainly Los Angeles, and New York City. We are doing that through a conversation with Felipe Fuentes and Assemblywoman Linda Rosenthal, and we can't wait for you to listen. We're also going to share a conversation we had with Ian Crone, host of the very popular podcast Typology, and our Outside of Politics, because we're talking about the Enneagram. You know it comes up all the time here at Pantsuit Politics, and we loved this conversation where we talked about the implications for the Enneagram in politics and political conversations.
We are bringing you new episodes through our summer series, and we'll be back in your ears some during our July break, depending on what the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack does. So we're holding all of those plans a little bit loosely. But if you find that you're missing our voices in your lives or your ears, we would just love to ask you again to check out our book, Now What? How to Move Forward When We're Divided About Basically Everything. We've received, especially since the Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case overturning Roe versus Wade, so many questions on how to have difficult conversations that are more necessary than ever in your families and churches and communities and online. We've done our best to answer those questions through our regularly published podcasts, but we would really love for you to sit down with our book because that's where we think we've done our best work on moving those conversations forward.
Next up, we'll share our conversation with Felipe Fuentes and Assemblywoman Linda Rosenthal.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Have you ever experienced a dry, itchy scalp or ever wondered why your color isn't lasting as long as your hairdresser promised? Well, unfiltered, mineral-filled water could be the reason why. Did you know hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin? And that about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered showerhead comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered showerhead. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered showerhead is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze. We put it in, it took like 30 seconds, guys. And its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered showerhead purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
I love spring. I feel like it's the perfect time to hit reset. Get rid of the things that don't work, bring in things that do work. With Nextivo Naturals CBD products, you can get rid of oil-based CBD, which doesn't work very well, and introduce CBD that will help you live well, happily, with less stress and greater sleep quality. Oil-based CBD just doesn't mix well with our bodies because our bodies are mostly water. But Nextivo Naturals developed a clinically tested, water-soluble form of CBD, and their gummies and capsules are proven to work faster and absorb better than oil-based products. For a limited time in April, you can get 60% off an order of $40 or more by using code PANTSUIT at Nextivo.com. I really value the sleep complex. It is CBD with melatonin, and it just helps take the edge off my day when my thoughts are racing as I hit the pillow. I can just kind of feel myself melting away. I wake up refreshed. I sleep all night. I think it is such a good product that has been, for years now, really valuable to me. Give your life a refresh with more effective and fast-acting CBD from Nextivo Naturals. For a limited time in April, get 60% off any order of $40 or more by using code PANTSUIT at Nextivo.com. That's 60% off any order of $40 or more only in April at Nextivo.com with promo code PANTSUIT.
When we started this series, we wanted to bring greater understanding and depth for all of us to regions of the country where we might not live. Well, that's a little challenging for big cities like New York City and Los Angeles, cities that many of us have visited, cities that many of us hear reported on all the time, cities that occupy such an outside space in our cultural conversations. And we thought it would be interesting to bring representatives from those two cities together to talk about what is missed in the national narrative and our cultural understanding of these two particular regions of the country.
So we are joined today by Felipe Fuentes, who served as a member of the Los Angeles City Council for 3 years and a member of the California State Assembly for 5 years. He currently works as a lobbyist, and we would be remiss if we did not mention that we've had the pleasure of spending time in person with Felipe and his wife, Lena. They are wonderful people and supporters of Pantsuit Politics, and we're delighted that he's here. Assemblywoman Linda Rosenthal currently represents District 67, which includes parts of Manhattan's Upper West Side and Hell's Kitchen neighborhoods in the New York State Assembly. She was first elected in 2006. And she was wonderful to talk with in this conversation. So with a lot of gratitude, here is our discussion with Felipe Fuentes and Assemblywoman Linda Rosenthal.
Thank you both so much for joining us here at Pantsuit Politics. We are thrilled to have you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for inviting us.
So we wanted to have you guys both here because the national narrative is often that, you know, the coasts get lumped together, defines and dominates so much of our conversation in America. And you see that, I think, manifest in a lot of resentment in the political realm. And it occurred to us that even using coasts shrinks down and characterizes two very distinct parts of the country. And so many years of representing your respective communities, LA and New York, what do people get wrong about your city when they say things like New York and LA, like they're one place? And Linda, I'll send that to you first.
I mean, I think something people get wrong about New York is that people are hostile, people are mean. That's a big, scary place. And in fact, we are a collection of small neighborhoods, sometimes as small as like 5 blocks can define a neighborhood. Mm. And people are actually very caring loving toward each other within those different neighborhoods. And we saw it displayed during COVID where people would go out of their way, risk their own lives, their own health to take care of a neighbor, to deliver food, to help someone they never met before. And so I think that's one of the misconceptions about New York in general. LA, I'm sure you can come up with your own misconceptions, but I mean, we think of LA as this unfriendly kind of car city where it's a lot of paparazzi, a lot of Hollywood, a lot of types. And the fact there are real people who live there and not everybody's stuck in their car on the freeway. But I think the unfriendliness moniker to New York is dreadfully wrong.
Yeah, I think the assembly members got it right. I mean, for better or for worse, folks think that, you know, Los Angeles is all Hollywood and paparazzi and that we're a little plasticky, you know, in sort of our sort of demeanor. But, you know, one thing that is sort of fun is that, you know, again, for better or for worse, we're always going to be the second largest, right? That's always sort of the second largest city in the country. For the time being, that's sort of what folks, you know, sort of think. And in some ways, you know, there's a healthy competition, I think, between New York and Los Angeles. I mean, they are both, you know, magnets. It's where people want to be. It's the people are drawn to cities, and the culture that comes out of both of those sort of constituencies and communities makes for culture. And I think it's one of the sort of things that we rival a little bit, but we celebrate. And I think that's what makes it so exciting.
Well, as Kentuckians, we are familiar with stereotypes that caricature where you live and what is represented there. So we can relate to at least that piece. You know, you're in places with very different histories that we wanted to talk about for a minute. New York was settled in the 1700s by the Dutch with this huge emphasis on commercialism and multiculturalism. L.A. was settled by the Spanish American empires, and where the Dutch and their descendants are largely gone from New York, Hispanic culture is still very prevalent in parts of Southern California, where you have less of an emphasis on commercial success and more on hard work. And we just wondered how you see these histories and cultures shaping your cities, especially politically. And I'd love to start with you, Felipe.
Well, listen, I think how you all started this series is really important. And it was really enlightening to me, the idea that Colin Woodward has put it forward there, that you've got these regions in this country, I think certainly rings true. And to your point, Beth, about sort of the history of both coasts, you know, I think that's what, in large part, because we're very Democratic, very blue states, we celebrate that. And for the left coast, at least, this sort of intersection between El Norte and the coast, the values that we have, sort of the history, I think makes for, you know, part of coming back to that healthy competition, a real pursuit to try to figure out how to be as accessible and equitable to the constituencies in the state. And you see that manifesting in the way sort of the elections are run and how cobalt blue we are. And it's envisioned with, you know, how it is that the state and local government spends money. They do a good job of sort of taking care of the things that need to be taken care of, but they extend their help, whether it's increasing access to undocumented, to saying to our neighboring states, come here for health services if your state, for some reason, doesn't want to offer them to women, as most recently we're experiencing. We have that history and really that pride. And it really is, I think, part of why it is that both coasts, for that matter, are so welcoming to people and to offering help.
Well, that's what, you know, Linda, what you said about New York. It strikes me that both New York and LA are almost like microcosms of what he's trying to do in his book. Like, really, you could break these cities down into regions by their history and by their populations and by their cultures. I mean, that's what you understand, I think, when you can stop saying New York, LA, and when you can stop saying New York. I mean, what part of New York? You know, the Upper West Side, Greenwich Village, Brooklyn, like they're just in the same with LA. Like, I'll never forget a friend saying, well, there's all these neighborhoods and you're not stuck in traffic because you figure out a way to live and work in your neighborhood. And that they're very distinct neighborhoods, and that emphasis on multiculturalism, I think, and this like pluralism to enormous commercial success in both cities, right, allows people the space to both maintain that history, maintain that culture in this bigger sort of ecosystem.
You know, I think that what we're experiencing here in New York City and New York State is the widening of the tent that is the Democratic Party and people on the left bringing up issues that have been buried for years, quite literally. And so we see that I was just at Lincoln Center, which is, you know, the beacon of culture here in New York City and in my district. And Lincoln Center was created because a neighborhood called San Juan Hill, which was full of Latinos, was bulldozed to create
West Side Story.
Exactly, exactly. And now the narrative is we have to unearth the history of the West Side, even though it's only been, I don't know, 50 years or something like that. It was Eisenhower, actually, who put in the first shovel, that we need to recognize where we came from and exposing, once again, our multicultural history. Because right now, Manhattan is very white. it used to be a much more integrated kind of borough, but for a variety of reasons, it's becoming, you know, very wealthy again, very wealthy and white. And so, but our history indicates otherwise. And whether it's from the, you know, Indian American tribes that were here in Manhattan and the rest of the city. So I think that's part of what is going on right here in our city is recognizing that we do have a wonderful history of diversity and being proud of that, celebrating it, but showing the rest of the world that that's what New York City, New York State came from.
But do you feel like Los Angeles is doing that dance too, that balance between gentrification and, you know, growing wealth and increased wealth? And how do we stay true to our history and our cultures in these neighborhoods? But also, listen, I mean, I think it is, I'm not saying anything controversial. Both cities have a value, have a strong emphasis on, you know, commercial success and business growth and entrepreneurship. And so it's like, how do you balance those two things if we're, you know, we're pluralistic and we find success, commercial and otherwise, in allowing these cultures, but also, you know, not crushing them or co-opting them, but allowing them to thrive? How do you feel like LA walks that line?
Yeah, it's difficult, you know, because it is both the blessing and the curse of being part of a magnet, you know, being a New York, being a Los Angeles, is that everybody wants to be here. And when you want to be here, you know, the folks who have the means and the resources typically sort of have an opportunity more so than folks that maybe were already there and established. And you see that playing out. I mean, you have, you know, it used to be in the good old days that the east side of Los Angeles was heavily Latino, Mexican-American initially. But now you've got, you know, sort of the folks who couldn't afford Hollywood Hills move a little bit further. And now they're, you know, in Eagle Rock and on the east side of Los Angeles. And it's not necessarily sort of the descendants of some of the folks who were there first. Is that a bad thing? You know, it's not a bad thing because it speaks to the success of Los Angeles. But when you start displacing folks or sort of changing the culture too rapidly, there's a tension. And it's beginning to manifest itself in some really interesting ways amongst Democrats, which to me, I don't know if this is an issue on the East Coast or in New York, but, you know, it used to be that if you were a Democrat, you believed in equity and access. Well, folks have really moved further left of that. And now you've got a real big movement of the democratic socialist sort of agenda, which is very different than equity and access. It's about free. And it's about, in some cases, as we saw in the Los Angeles City Council election, this primary, an abolitionist to the police department getting elected for the first time to the city council. So, but that comes out of sort of that frustration of how things are changing and the gentrification, and it happens to all be sort of playing out on the east side of Los Angeles right now. But, you know, it's both the blessing and the curse. I mean, you know, without that, we would have sort of stagnation and we wouldn't be that beacon that Los Angeles wants to be.
Are you seeing that where you are, Assemblywoman, that you spoke about the expansion of the tent? I'm wondering if those comments connect with you.
I do, but I think that's more concentrated on New York City, not New York State. And we saw that just yesterday, or just on June 28th, the primary, where we had a Working Families Party / DSA candidates running for governor and lieutenant governor, and they lost. They lost decisively. And so the statewide, the more mainstream kind of Democrat won the primary as expected. But in the city, there is certainly a city council that has elected more DSA than ever before. The fight about defund the police, does that mean literally get rid of the police, or just, you know, make sure their budgets are not over what they should get, but competent and enough to make sure that they can do their job, but not be racist, for example, and, you know, et cetera. So although the mayor that we have is a moderate. So I think every group is fighting for who's the top dog, as it were. And that will continue to play out. I think that happens throughout history. But, you know, people want to believe in their government. And I feel like right now, that's teetering. We certainly don't believe in the Supreme Court these days. I think everybody has to make sure that their constituency is satisfied, and we need to, as government officials, at least I feel we need to deliver the services for them. Everyone can feel safe. Everyone can feel that listened to, heard, and taken care of. And that's very, very difficult these days, even though it's a simple sounding task.
I think it's really helpful to hear you both talk about this as a negotiation and how you are trying to work out how to be fair and just among all these constituencies, because, you know, sitting in Kentucky, so often writers, thinkers, politicians here will co-opt the language coming out of New York and LA, the most extreme of that language, to hold it up as a representative of what all Democrats think. And yeah, I remember being in a home in Washington, D.C. and talking to a minister who was telling us about the city and his perspective. And he said, Washington, D.C. is a city of pornographic wealth and abject poverty. And the more we talked about it, the more I thought, you know, we have income inequality in Kentucky, but nothing like this. We have no idea how extreme the constituencies are in both directions, because we don't have the commercial success and the history of commercial success of these cities. And so I think it's just really valuable to hear you describe the way you're working through all these constituencies as unique local issues. I haven't heard either of you say anything about national politics beyond the Supreme Court yet. And that really jumps out at me.
You know, I think part of it is that, you know, you're talking about two really big states and two really big cities. You know, you best believe that folks are hopping mad in California right now. We've had, you know, a number of protests. There are efforts. In fact, our governor just entered into a commitment with Oregon and Washington on reproductive access and rights for women. There was we're putting on a constitutional amendment in California to make sure that it's a right, the access in our constitution. It's enshrined in California. So, you know, the good news is that you've got a really active constituency in the state and in Los Angeles. But to your point, Beth, it is messy. This conversation on sort of, you know, equity and how it is that it manifests itself in politics, and it's playing out between Democrats in California. But the good news is that I think the net result will be, you know, a stronger, more cohesive party eventually. But we're in an interesting time, I think, as Democrats in California, for sure.
You know, I think women in particular, obviously in New York, are just outraged about the recent decisions. And the fact is, in 1970, New York State allowed legal abortions. So we are ahead of our time. And we recently passed 5 new laws that protect medical providers. I sponsored 2 of those that protect against extradition. We passed some good gun legislation, and we're actually getting called into an extraordinary session in Albany to further protect our residents here in the state when it comes to where someone can get a gun or use or carry a gun, since the Supreme Court struck down New York's law about limiting where guns can be carried outside of the home. So, but I do see the friction and the problem with housing inequality here in New York City is it's out of control. You have people spending $100 million for an apartment they might live in 5 nights a year. And downstairs on the street, literally in front of the entrance of that building, are people who are homeless. And I know the same thing is true in California, for sure. And we have yet to figure out how to fix that inequity, that we allow people to sleep on the ground and do not provide them with housing. Even though in New York City, people who are unsheltered must have a place to stay in every night. But this is something that I think it's certainly a nationwide phenomenon about the poor and the rich, and what are we doing to take care of our people?
I think that issue is both the most intensely felt on the ground in these cities and also the most manipulated in the national media for sort of talking points. So what do you think people miss, you know, when they're talking about California housing prices or rents in New York? What's getting missed when that rises to the level of the national narrative?
You know, what is tough about it is, you know, is not sort of addressing sort of the successes. It's simple economics, right? It's supply and demand, and folks want to be here, right? Despite sort of the rhetoric that you hear from some of our neighboring states and sort of why there's this exodus from California, the simple truth is that folks in industry, their success here. And as a result of that, you know, that is constraining sort of the supply of housing. And then right now, these terrible economic times that we find ourselves in with inflation, the COVID hangover that we've got with the supply chain being disrupted, it's not helping very much. And it's not for the sake of policymakers not trying to help and address a solution. A subsidized unit of housing right now, rental housing, is $500,000. I mean, think about that for a second, what you could do with that $500,000 outside of California. But even so, we're behind the curve in our housing production. So, you know, it's easy to sort of point to the deficiencies, a little tougher to sort of sing the praises of why it is that this state is so successful and some of the consequences. And so there's certainly a lot that can be done from a policy perspective to afford more housing stock and access to it. And policymakers are trying their best. They're in session now, you know, debating bills literally that I was monitoring just a little bit ago on sort of how to bring down the costs. But, you know, it speaks to the success. But, you know, we talk about the warts before we talk about the beauty sometimes.
But I would say here in New York, real estate is king. Real estate runs the show, runs the town, and to the detriment often of the people who live here and are struggling to live here. So many of our renters are rent burdened, meaning they pay more than 30% of their income on rent. And we had this tax giveaway program called 421A was the section of law. And developers would get tax breaks for 30 years, 40 years, if they built a small number of affordable units. And what we found is that we have foregone as a city billions of dollars, billions upon billions of dollars. And in return, we have not gotten enough affordable housing. And so that program has expired. We as a legislature did not allow a new one to be put into the budget the way the governor wanted, because we can't throw away money like that anymore. And I think real estate is starting to learn that, that the legislature, which is more Democrats leaning more left these days, that we're not prepared to play that game anymore. We really need development of affordable housing and supportive housing without giving away the store. And that is the challenge that is before us. As we walk down the street and see homeless families pitching makeshift tents because there's nowhere for them to live.
Well, it is very helpful to hear your perspective on this and to get your expertise, and a real gift for you two to share your time with us. So thank you so much. And we will be sure to put information on how listeners can stay in touch with both of you in our show notes.
Thank you for having us. Assemblymember, very nice having you. Nice talking to you.
Nice meeting you as well.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm not a research scientist, but I know that having a good hair day correlates with a good mood for me. And I have many more good hair days since I've been using Pros. I use the Pros shampoo, conditioner, curl cream, gel, and occasionally the hair mask. These products were formulated specifically for me, Not for my hair type, but for me. What I eat, where I live, the specific issues that worry me about my naturally curly and very thick hair. Since I've been using Pros, I've noticed that I can go longer between washes without my hair looking dull or feeling oily. I've noticed that my curl structure is stronger and healthier. I've noticed that my hair has figured out how it wants to just lie on my head. I'm not fighting with it every day anymore. I feel like my hair and I have come to a peace truce. And that is really emotionally beneficial to me, in addition to producing lots of compliments on my hair everywhere I go. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/pantsuit. So get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/pantsuit. That's PROSE.com/pantsuit.
You know we love rituals to celebrate the changing seasons and the different celebrations in our lives. You guys, this year I committed to Olive and June as a part of my ritual. I really wanted to paint my nails more regularly, and I have done a great job. I don't mean to brag on myself, mainly because they make it so easy. It's really, really all about that Manny system, especially the nail strengthener, which I'm very passionate about. I just love using the colors to mark the fun things happening in my week. Lime Fizz for St. Patrick's Day, Sequin Everything when I went to the beach, Grateful and Kind for Valentine's Day week. I just think it puts a little pep in my step. And they make it so easy with the system. The manicures last so long. It's like $2 a manicure, basically. They always have the most amazing polishes. I love following their Instagram for ideas about manicures. I just love everything about Olive and June. That's the long and short of it, guys. Visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Manny system.
Thank you so much to them for that great conversation. And now we're going to share another conversation we recently had with Ian Crone. We know so many of you are fans of the Typology podcast. He is also the best-selling author of The Road Back to You and now has the greatly anticipated follow-up, The Story of You, out. And it asks the hard questions, are you living in the wrong story? And he challenges readers to rethink stale stories and outdated messages often learned in childhood. And with the use of the Enneagram, unlock the inner power for both spiritual and personal growth, and helped us use the Enneagram to unlock some insights around our political identities and political conversations. We talk about the Enneagram all the time on Pantsuit Politics. But for those uninitiated, I don't know how they would be. But in case they are in our audience, what is the Enneagram and why is this ancient typing system so popular right now?
Sure. Well, the Enneagram is an ancient personality typing system. It teaches there are 9 basic personality styles in the world, one of which we gravitate toward and adopt in childhood as a way to cope, to feel safe, to navigate the new world of relationships. Each type has a unconscious motivation that powerfully influences how that personality type predictably and habitually acts, thinks, and feels from moment to moment on a daily basis. Why is it so important? Gosh, don't you think everybody wants to know what makes them and other people tick? I think the biggest mystery each of us has to face on a daily basis is ourselves. Mm. And which of us doesn't want to have a higher resolution picture of our interior world?
Well, in your book, The Story of You, An Enneagram Journey to Becoming Your True Self, you talk about how we tend to adopt this story about ourselves in childhood and carry it into adulthood. And the Enneagram gives us the potential to transform that story from one that is harmful to us to one that is helpful to us. That seems relevant to politics. Mm-hmm. Mm. And we would love to hear how you see those stories impacting the way we tend to think. Our political opinions and choices are just very rational calculations based on policy, but perhaps might have other factors going on.
Oh my gosh. There was a study done not very long ago. It was based on another personality typing system called the Big Five. And what they discovered is that our political leanings are not entirely based on opinion as much as on temperament and disposition and personality, which is really interesting to me. So for example, if you're typically, now, of course, there are, these are large generalizations with tons of exceptions to the rule. But the numbers that tend to be more conscientious types often skew more conservative. And other types that tend to have what we call high openness to experience, they trend more liberal in their worldview. And so what people don't understand is they think, oh, it's a completely rational decision, the way I make political choices. It's like, actually, there are unconscious forces that work in the shadows that powerfully shape our political viewpoints. You know, I'm a both and thinker. I'm a 4 on the Enneagram. My son is a 7. He's a both and thinker. My daughter is an 8. She tends to be an either or thinker, although not as nearly as much as she did when she was a younger woman. And, you know, I'm a 4, right? So I tend to trend more liberal. I mean, I just know that part of that is my temperament. It's my disposition. It's in art. I tend to be very much a both and thinker, as a writer, as a thinker. I have other people in the family who trend conservative, and they really tend to be conscientious types, like 1s, 2s, sometimes 6s, not the counterphobic, but the phobic 6. You know, again, that's the self-knowledge, right? Mm. If you have the self-knowledge, you know, you can begin to, you know, in a conversation with somebody who takes a different viewpoint, stand back from your experience, observe what's happening inside. You feel the anger, the frustration coming up, and you're like, huh, is that helpful?
True.
You know?
Feels so good, though.
Oh, yeah.
I think something else that Enneagram has helped me with politically is learning not to make a lot of assumptions about other people. You know, when you start to find how rich the Enneagram is as a tool for self-understanding and transformation, my instinct anyway is to kind of look at all the people around me and be like, oh, you are a 7, and that's what's going on here. And the more deeply you explore the Enneagram, the more you realize, I can't really know that. I can't know whether that's a 7 or not. I can just observe the behavior, and I need to let this person tell me their own story and kind of live in their own story. And I am trying to take that framework into political discussions as well, and to not just say, oh, you are a Democrat or a Republican or from Georgia or whatever, but to realize there's a lot that I cannot unravel from the outside of a person.
Yes, that's absolutely true, because people are wildly complex. We have to remember that people have trauma. People have all kinds of other forces in their life that shape their worldview, that actually craft the narrative that they inhabit, right? And the vast majority of people, unless they've done some work, are utterly unaware of how these things are affecting the way they see the world. Here's something that most people, this is a great error. Most people think they know themselves and are in much more control of their lives than they actually are. And until you begin to do the work, you just sort of live in this sort of bubble of delusion about how in charge you are of the things you act, the way that you act, think, and feel.
That's why I find your new book really empowering and helpful, because it is difficult to truly comprehend how powerful those childhood narratives are and how deeply embedded they are. And I'm wondering, like, how you started down this road, how you went from a tool that can help us so much in the present to using it to excavate the past.
Yeah, and chart a course for the future. So, gosh, years ago, for your listeners who probably don't know, I'm in recovery for alcohol and drug addiction. I've been a 12-step community for decades that, you know, are I call them my litter mates, people who are trying to figure out how to live in the world with a new spiritual design for living, right? And when I was very early in sobriety, I mean, like, you know, straight out of treatment, I had this sponsor, and he was a 70-year-old Episcopal priest, Jungian analyst, super smart. And I told my story one night at a meeting. I had like half an hour to tell my story, and it was just full of all kinds of Enneagram 4 stuff. I didn't even know the Enneagram then, but I remember it. It was like, oh, you know, all my life I felt different, and all my life I felt like I was an isle of misfit toys and habitat. You know what I mean? And it was just full of this angst, existential drama, and which is all very typical for kind of territory. And at the end of it, I drove him home, and he looked at me at one point and he said, Ian, what if the story you tell yourself about who you are isn't true? Like, what if the story you tell others about who you are and how you see the world is not true, right? It's like, and I was like thrown back on my heels. I was like, wait a minute. I just thought the story I understand my life to be was handed to me. And I, you know, and it's like, I don't have any choices. And he made me realize in that moment, wait a second, all of us occupy a story. And for the most part, the story we come up with as little kids isn't true anymore in adulthood. And unless we rewrite that story, craft a new narrative of our own design, we are stuck in a prison we don't know we're in. And, you know, those are very secure prisons, the ones you don't know you're in.
I notice in my own life, much of what I learned in therapy that has been so helpful to me, a lot of what I have read that has really influenced the way that I think, I'm thinking of Brené Brown's work, for example, comes out of the recovery community. And I wonder how you see a connection between those tenets that you start to explore in the recovery community and the Enneagram. Because sometimes I think to myself, is there a way to access this wisdom without going through the suffering first? And is that what the Enneagram is here to help us with? How do we do that?
Well, I will say this. Suffering is a great motivator. And, you know, it's like, do the work or die. I mean, that's, you know, it's, and that's sort of a message you learn early in recovery. It's like, well, we're going to give you some suggestions as to how you might live your life. And you're free to choose whether to accept those suggestions or not. But if you choose not to, the result is death, you know? So, you know, those are pretty good. And those are pretty motivating words, right? And it's true. There is such a wealth of knowledge in the 12-step world for everybody. It's, you know, it's amazing to me. You know, sometimes I'll be out and someone will go, they'll learn that I'm a recovering addict alcoholic, and they'll be like, oh, I'll pray for you. Let's say they're a person of faith, right? And I'll be like, no, I'm going to pray for you, because if you think you're not an addict, then you're baddie. Everybody is a seething cauldron of addiction. The benefit of being an alcoholic or a drug addict is eventually your addiction goes public, right? And you have no choice but to deal with it. Most people have addictions to whether it's work or to approval or to being right or whatever it might be. And those addictions, even, you know, think about it, you know, an addiction to success and money and material goods, you know, people actually applaud those addictions, and yet they make people miserable ultimately. And can cause as much damage to your health and to your relationships as a good old drinking or drug problem, really. Mm. I mean, so I guess the point I'm making is I think what the Enneagram does as it blends with 12-step wisdom is it helps us to come face to face with the truth about who we are and who we aren't. We have opportunities for growth and transformation that are before us if we choose to take advantage of them. One of the things I tell people all the time is if you're looking for flattery, don't play around with the Enneagram. Mm. Like, you know, go take Strengths Finders. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, if you want someone to pat you on the back, I mean, I like Strengths Finders. I'm just saying, it's got a point, but I want to know not only what's great about me, I also want to know like what's holding me back from becoming mm-hmm. the highest expression of myself.
I wonder, as you look at America and American politics, what you think we're addicted to.
Being right. Mm. I think that's, and you know, we're addicted to rage.
Yeah.
You know, rage is powerful. Let's face it. Getting angry, there's a side to it that's just delicious.
Oh yeah. Feels great. I love it.
Oh, it
self-righteousness is my favorite emotion.
Right. It's like, yummy. You know, I love to be right. And of course we all know that it's like a little bit like a drug, right? It might feel good, but it's killing you. You know, it's corrosive to your relationships and to your own heart, you know, to your own heart. And it doesn't contribute to the well-being of the world. It just doesn't. You know, there was a time, I think, when people didn't confuse their identity with their politics. In other words, you know, like, for example, my mom was kind of a liberal, and my dad was a Bill Buckley conservative, right? You know, I grew up in New England, and every, you know, as you can imagine, Bill Buckley conservative versus, my mom voted for, you know, Hillary Clinton. My dad would definitely not have done that, you know. And yet they didn't have any problems in their marriage around politics because those were opinions. They were separate from their identity. It was like, I'm Ian Cron, and I happen to have this political world view or opinion, but they weren't. Nowadays, if you disagree with someone's politics, it's as though it feels like an attack on your identity, mm-hmm. on your very person. And if this, that makes the stakes super high. And, you know, I also think that the whole mix of politics and religion, nationalism and religion, is super dangerous. We all know what theocracies look like. Mm. And it, you know, sometimes I worry that there are some people in our midst who would like to create another one, you know? And, you know, which is why you should never introduce religion into politics. They don't mix, because religion doesn't operate in the sphere of compromise. And when you put politics and religion together, religion always ends up bullied.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think that that's all true and powerful. And I think that's why individually acts of self-discovery and self-awareness feel like political acts in today's day and age. I think, you know, being able to use the tools available to you and with guidance from people like you and your work, it matters. I really think it matters. The more self-awareness we can bring, the more we can use these tools in our own lives to loosen that grip on anger and righteousness. Like I said, I think it's like truly a political act. So thank you. Thank you for your books and your work on the Enneagram. I know they've helped us and a lot of other people. And thanks for coming on our show.
Man, what a delight. Thanks for having me.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never-frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious. And Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code pantsuit50 at factormeals.com/pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you to Ian Felipe and Assemblywoman Rosenthal for joining us. Thank you to all of you for tuning in to Pantsuit Politics week after week. We will be off next week, but then we'll be joining you, dependent again on the schedule of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attacks on the United States Capitol. We hope all of you have the best July available to you. And until we join you again, keep it nuanced, y'all.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production. Elise Knapp is our managing director.
Maggie Penton is our community engagement manager. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Martha Brunitsky.
Linda Daniel.
Allie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Helen Handley.
Tiffany Hassler.
Emily Holiday.
Katie Johnson.
Katina Zuganellis-Kasling.
Barry Kaufman.
Molly Kors.
The Creeps!
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
Emily Neasley.
The Pattons!
Tawny Peterson.
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Katie Stigers.
Karen True.
Annika Uvaline.
Nick and Elisa Vallelli.
Katherine Vollmer.
Amy Whited.
Jeff Davis.
Melinda Johnston. Ashley Thompson. Michelle Wood. Joshua Allen. Morgan McHugh. Nicole Berkless. Paula Bremer. And Tim Miller.